Hi, I'm Kirk Cameron. Thanks for joining us today, and welcome to Takeaways. Now, you might be wondering, what is Takeaways? I mean, what am I watching here? Well, think about it. You and I have been bombarded with opinions, with opposing headlines, reasons to be afraid, reasons to be angry, and all of that is at the expense of important, respectful, thoughtful conversations that would help inform our minds and help us know what to do to take action. So as a result, we feel frustrated and we can feel confused, not knowing what to believe because we're not sure what's true and what's not. And most importantly, what can we do to help? Do you relate? That's why I'm so excited to discuss issues with you that are impacting our families and our society, together with knowledgeable guests who also have character, and then offer actionable takeaways, steps that you can take today, this week, this month, to join the solution and better your family, your community, and your nation. So let's talk about it right now on Takeaways. They're saying that atheism has doubled in this young generation.
Do you think that's true?
And why the shift?
Socialism and progressivism are very illiberal.
The greatest crisis that our kids are going to have to deal with in 20 to 30 years.
Is it global warming? Is it another pandemic? Is it something worse than that?
Whom do you fear more? Do you fear Facebook more or God more? Every religious person should ask themselves that question.
Joining us now is best-selling author, a columnist, and nationally syndicated radio talk show host, Dennis Prager. Dennis, I'm so grateful to be talking with you. Thanks for joining us on Takeaways. I'm particularly interested in talking with you about faith and about family. So many of our viewers are parents or grandparents. I have six kids, they're getting married, they're thinking about kids. I'm looking at grandkids in the near future, and all of us are understandably concerned about the potential future of the world in which our kids are gonna be living. So let me share with you something from a new report that came out that says that among Gen Z, the population of nuns has doubled. And they're not talking about women in habits who have taken a vow of chastity. They're talking about those who, when asked, what's your religious affiliation, they say, none. They're saying that atheism has doubled in this young generation. Do you think that's true? And why the shift?
There's no question it's true. It's been increasing for 100 years. When you are immersed, bathed in a sea of secularism, what do you expect the results to be? Kids are taught by secular teachers in secular schools, watch secular movies. Everything is secular. It would be like asking somebody in medieval Italy to be an atheist as opposed to a Catholic. Everything was Catholic around him, so he was a Catholic. So everything around them is secular, so they're secular. And it's a given in their schools that that is the only way to approach life if you are a rational human being. They are, because that's all they've been exposed to, including at home. And even if the parents believe in God, they have not been given the single most important answer to the most important question. Not does God exist, why is God important?
Well, I think you make such great points. And, you know, it's true. I've heard it said, if we send our children to Caesar to be educated, we shouldn't be surprised if they come back Romans. And if we're sending our kids to that kind of schooling, what would we expect when they're being discipled by it? However, when we look around the world, the world, not just the United States, but the world is overwhelmingly religious. You have billions of Muslims, billions of Christians, you have all of these Hindus. And it's interesting to me that the Bible that we believe in says that God doesn't believe in atheists. He's given so much evidence of his existence that they're without an excuse. When I look at the sun and the moon and the stars and the birth of my children and the sunset and all of these things, I think I have hidden agendas if I'm going to determine that all of this came about without a divine creator. History demonstrates that atheism is really a dying idea. It's a fruitless worldview, and it ultimately produces the kinds of totalitarian regimes and dictatorships that really result in disaster for the people who are underneath those kinds of governments.
The consequences of secularism are disaster. As I tell my fellow Jews, most of whom don't listen to me on this matter, but I tell them, you know, you should just be aware, when Christianity died in Europe, we got fascism, communism, and Nazism. Why would you want it to die in America?
Great point. Speaking of things that are under attack in our culture, I'd love to talk with you about family for just a moment and the importance of it. There was a movie that I saw that really impacted me called The Giver. Had some great actors in it. Jeff Bridges, Meryl Streep, even Taylor Swift was playing a small role in this movie, where you had this utopian society controlled by this elite group of elders, and they took away everyone's choices because they thought they'd make bad choices. So they controlled the weather so that all the crops would grow. They took away your feelings of joy or anger or hatred so there would be no jealousy or wars. And importantly, they took away the family. And so when children were born, they had certain standards to meet, and if they didn't meet the height and weight standards, they were released into elsewhere. And the ones that survived were placed not into homes, but dwellings, not into families, but units. They didn't get a mom and a dad, but a parent who was appointed, and they didn't have last names. They were just first name only. And then they donated their childhood to the organization or the community, and they thanked them for their service, and then appointed them to their vocation for the rest of their life. Why not just do away with the family and have children be property of the state and let them educate them in the way that they want? Why would that be a bad idea?
Well, I'll tell you why it's a bad idea, but before that, I just want you to know it's already happening. I've gone through different periods of my life asking myself, so what's the most important of the Ten Commandments? There was a long time I thought it was do not steal, because murder is the stealing of a life, adultery is the stealing of a spouse, coveting is the desire to steal something that belongs to another.
Right.
But in the last few years, I've come to think honor your father and mother is the most important one. And there's evidence from within the Ten Commandments, because it is the only one of the Ten Commandments which promises a reward. You will live long on the land that I give you. Your society will only survive if children honor parents, which means if there's parental authority. The first thing every cult does is try to sever parental authority. This was done by the Nazis. This was done by the communists. This was done by all the little cults that developed, like the one where they drank the Kool-Aid, which is where we get the idea of drinking Kool-Aid from. And that's what they do. In Nazi Germany, your loyalty was to Hitler, not to your parents. In communist Soviet Union, you took a loyalty oath to the party, not to your parents. The family is the bulwark against totalitarianism. The left everywhere, there's no exception, seeks to be totalitarian, not liberals. I distinguish between liberals and the left. The liberals are naive and they don't fight the left, but they're not leftists. But the left always creates a totalitarian state wherever they can. And it begins with the substitution of state authority for parental authority.
That should just serve as a call to all of us as moms and dads and grandparents to see our calling as a sacred duty to raise our children and to give them the values that are important for their future and the future of humanity. Perhaps the greatest crisis that our kids are going to have to deal with in 20 to 30 years. I mean, is it global warming? Is it another pandemic? Is it something worse than that? What should we really be thinking about and praying about?
Well, you don't need to go to 20 to 30 years. It's immediate. The crisis is here right now. 20 to 30 years from now is way too late. Your kids are told the following. Your future is death, existential threat of global warming, one of the grandiose lies of history. Not that the Earth is not getting warmer. That's not the lie. The lie is that it's an existential threat. It means a threat to the existence of the world. That's a lie. It's not a lie that the Earth is getting warmer. So your future is death and your past is awful. You're the founders of this country were scum. That's basically what they're taught. So you have no past and you have no future. That's what they get going to school, which is why parents should take their kids out of most schools.
Do you have hope? And if you do, what are some opportunities that kids can take advantage of to prepare themselves for what they can do? What are some opportunities as parents that we can do to help prepare our kids for the future?
The first thing people need to understand in answering your question is what's the problem? The problem is that whatever the left touches, it destroys. Look at what it's done to colleges and the arts and everything else that I enumerated. Therefore, why would you send your child to a regular school, private or public? That's not just public schools. You know, the claim of the left is we teach the bad as well as the good about America. But it's a huge lie because they don't teach anything good about America. No conservative objects to teaching the bad about America. But we want to teach young people that along with the bad, this has been the best country ever devised. Not because, I don't say it because I'm American, I'm saying it because it's true. The best thing that could happen tomorrow is millions of parents take their kids out of schools, homeschool them, or send them to a school that doesn't teach them lies about American history. Those are your only two choices, a decent school or homeschool. But continuing to send them to regular school and then shipping them off to college, which is so bad that I came up with a little meme. About the college years, better intoxicated than indoctrinated.
Dennis, let me ask you, do you think that we are raising thoughtful children today, or are we creating clones in our schools who are programmed with only one train of thought?
We haven't been raising thoughtful children since World War II. That's why the baby boomers are blamed. And to a large extent, I think validity for the terrible crisis in our civilization. We don't raise thoughtful kids at school. If you think differently than the teacher, you are smeared as white supremacist, racist, homophobic, Islamophobic, whatever the term du jour is. That's the last thing that kids are taught. Look, if you have to say men give birth, then clearly you're not taught to think. Men do not give birth. It's almost trite to say men give birth is a lie. Men give birth is an absurdity. It transcends lie. And everybody knows that it's an absurdity, but you have to go along with what is now demanded of you. Otherwise, you are faced, in many cases, terrible consequences, what they call the cancel culture. Men don't give birth. But now the sciences have even been corrupted because now many medical groups are using birthing person instead of mother. Mm. Birthing person, yeah.
How can so many people buy into absurdities and lies? How do you make sense of that? I mean, why would doctors buy into that? Why would trained professionals, educated people, all be complicit in something that we know is taking us down a wrong road and seems to defy logic and reality? How does a whole thing like that even come about?
There are two answers, and that is brainwash and cowardice. Bad combination. First, the brainwash. Apparently, for most people, not all, but most, unfortunately, which is why the founders didn't believe in making a democracy but a republic, because they knew that the majority could so often be wrong. For most people, if they hear something enough, they believe it. I studied oddly enough, very few people had this as a major. I studied communist affairs and totalitarianism. I was at Columbia University Graduate School of International Affairs. And I studied Russian, so I read the Soviet communist newspaper every day, Pravda. And I believed for much of my life that it was only possible for the media to brainwash a population in a dictatorship. But I was wrong. I've realized only in the last few years the media could brainwash people in a free country. And that is what has happened here. I mean, if you're told something enough, no matter how absurd it is, then you will believe it. And the other is cowardice. People are not courageous by nature. Courage is the rarest of all the good traits. There are many kind people, but there are very few courageous people. And kindness without courage is worthless. So since people don't want to be unliked, disliked, or even hated, they go along with the majority. Those are my two answers to your question, how could this happen?
Well, Dennis, one of the things that I love is the fact that you're helping to fight against this brainwashing. We get it everywhere that we go. It's on our phones, on our computers, it's everywhere. It's in music and movies. It just seems like the wrong set of values are being pumped into our homes every single day. And with what you're doing at PragerU and the PragerU videos, I just love them. I appreciate them on a personal level, not only for myself, but also for my kids. What can you suggest as an antidote for cowardice? Where do you personally find your courage to do what you do?
I've thought about this a lot. I even gave a lecture on how to become a courageous person. It's available. I'm not trying to sell anything, but I don't even own the rights to it. My syndicator does. The Prager store, I mean, I don't know, it's $10. It's really nothing. But I just want people to know I actually gave a lecture on this because I've thought about it so hard. But in a nutshell, without telling people how to develop it, where does it come from is what you asked. So I think it comes in many cases from one's own nature. I've always thought if I grew up in a communist country, I would have been sent to the gulag. I can't handle faking it. It's against my nature. The other is I fear God, and therefore I don't fear man. Most religious people fear people more than they fear God. Most religious people are not religious. It's not an attack. It's not a lament. It's just a fact. Most religious people, their religiosity is pretty superficial. And this is a perfect example. Whom do you fear more? Do you fear Facebook more or God more? Every religious person should ask themselves that question. Then they'll get courage.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I've read that.
That's another,
over and over that, and over.
Yes. It's also the beginning of courage. There is no wisdom in any secular institution. That proves that verse from the Bible is accurate. Name me one secular institution with wisdom. There is not a university with wisdom, and they're all secular. The most secular institution is the stupidest. That's where you learn men give birth, at college. College is radically godless and secular.
Oh boy! If our parents and grandparents, could only listen to the conversations that are happening around our coffee tables these days, they would be shocked that we're even having these kinds of conversations. But we are. It's the reality. It's the day we live in. And I just want to just highlight and mention the value of PragerU videos. They're so great. I just love the way that you distill complicated topics into their essence. And within 5 minutes or less, we can learn about what socialism is, what communism is, what totalitarianism is, what a republic is, what it means to be woke or what it means to be racist or what it means to be whatever and what it doesn't mean. And I'm so grateful for those things.
Well, thank you for mentioning it. I will say people can dismiss it because my last name, coincidentally, is the same as PragerU. But there's no doubt in my mind that if your child studied the 500 five-minute videos that we have up and the associated readings, they would know more and they would be far wiser and happier human beings than if they went to Princeton. And it will not only cost you less monetarily, it will cost you less in heartache.
That's right.
You know, when I meet parents with traditional values, I'm very forward with strangers. And so I say, how many kids do you have? Let's say they say 3, 4. I say, so I'm curious, how many of them share your values? And almost none say all of them. And some say none of them. They went to college.
Dennis, I'm 50 years old. My plumb line for truth is the scriptures. I love and fear God. That's the source of my courage and my wisdom. Let me ask you, how do you make your faith and your family values attractive to your kids so that they would buy in to these values? I mean, how are you personally presenting this in a way that's going to be attractive to those you love the most?
Right.
And how's it working?
Well, if parents don't talk about good values to their children constantly, there's no chance. And that's about America, and it's about God, and it's about the Bible. It's about all of these things. So that was one thing that I did. I didn't drive them crazy, but I would talk about it. Another one in my case, which I wish more Christians took seriously, is the Sabbath. One day a week, leaving the world and devoting it to family, friends, and synagogue or church is life transforming. I cannot imagine a religious life. I can't even imagine a happy life without the Sabbath. One day a week to tune out of media. I mean, I do media for a living. I don't listen to radio, watch TV, or go to the movies. It is a day for family, friends, and God. It's a pretty powerful combination. And it is the source of a big source of my happiness and of my stability and of my religiosity. It's the only ritual in the Ten Commandments, and the Bible's filled with rituals. It used to be important in America, Sunday. And this is an example of how I say secularism or the left has influenced the religious far more than the religious have influenced the society. I mean, the Sabbath is a perfect example. It was a very, very big deal in American history. It is basically nothing today, including for most Christians.
I was not raised in a religious home, and so my mom and dad didn't take the Sabbath and treat it as holy. We were playing around, going to the beach and body surfing in Santa Monica, and we were watching TV and doing those things. We didn't go to church, but fortunately, thankfully, God rescued me, and he changed my heart, and he opened my eyes, and I lost my faith in atheism at 17, 18 years old, and I looked up and I said, I want to become the person that you created me to be. And it was someone who took me to church, and I heard a message that changed my life. So I'm so grateful for that. And today, I'm doing what you're saying. The Shema has been the foundation for us raising our kids and talking about the important things like you're saying. And I would add to that, maybe in the new and updated version of the Shema, maybe the PragerU Foundational 500 will be tacked on to the end. Dennis, thanks so much for joining us today. Up next, everybody, we're going to continue the conversation on education with Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh D'Souza is a renowned filmmaker. He's an award-winning author and a cultural commentator. He's done highly publicized debates about politics and Christianity. He was even named one of America's most influential conservative thinkers by the New York Times Magazine. Dinesh, welcome to Takeaways.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kirk. It's a pleasure to join you.
You have written articles about education. You've written books about education. You've made movies that deal with education. You've spent so many times speaking on college campuses, and you've studied the subject of what kids are learning. Number one question, do you think that our kids and grandkids are being better educated or worse educated than they were a few generations ago? And are we creating better thinkers or worse thinkers with all of the information that we're providing them today?
I think that we are seeing a sharp decline in the quality of education, not just from a few generations ago, but even from one generation ago, which is basically when I came to America as an exchange student from India. I spent a year in high school, in a public school in Arizona, and then I went to college in the United States, Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. And now education, you know, is different at the school level than it is at the college level. I would say that at the school level, it's an introduction to ideas and a kind of answer to the sort of basic questions that young people ask about life. I mean, think about that natural curiosity that you have as a kid, where you just look around you and you say things like, well, why does a tree grow? Why is the sky blue? Why does the ocean recede and then come back out? In other words, why do the tides go back and forth? Why are human beings different from, say, other animals? How is it that we can speak? Why do people in different countries use different languages? Why don't we all speak the same language? So there's a kind of natural human wonder, which is anchored in the desire to know. And so a good school will tap into that and will, on the basis of that, introduce young people to like all the basics. Now, when you go to college, you undertake something a little different, I would say. And that is the enterprise of really learning critical thinking, critical reasoning, and a certain kind of healthy skepticism, a skepticism that doesn't deny truth, but recognizes that truth in some cases is kind of elusive. You don't really know how to find it. You aren't sure if it's absolute truth or just truth that is truth for now. So this is the mission of schools and colleges. Now, you only have to outline it to realize how little of it is actually going on today, particularly in the public schools. Young people graduate, and they don't even have basic cultural literacy. And then they go on to college, and the one thing that they need to learn, which is critical reasoning, they usually don't learn. And this is even true in our best schools and universities. So it's not that we don't send smart kids, but smartness is not enough because we need to have an educated intelligence, and an educated intelligence is one in which you learn how to have arguments that go back and forth. You learn how to see even the force of an argument from the other side, an argument that you disagree with. So that if someone were to say to you, you know, you are, let's just say, for example, Kirk, you and I are believers, but if someone were to say to us, can you state the most forceful argument that you can for atheism? Education is partly enabling us to do that. Even though we think that argument can be answered, we are open-minded enough to understand why someone might hold a different position than we do. So unfortunately, all of this which I think was at one time kind of central to what education is all about, is today pushed aside in favor of new forms of indoctrination that are going on both in the schools and in the universities.
Isn't it true that the term being liberal, in a classic sense, meant that you didn't just have to stick with the old ways, that you could discuss new ways, and we could bring it all to the table and discuss it? But it seems now that has shifted now to something as like, no, we just actually want to hate the old ways, and we want to go to these new ways, and no other ways are allowed, and then that. There comes the indoctrination. How did that whole shift take place?
It took place because classical liberalism became replaced with what is now sometimes called progressivism or socialism. But socialism and progressivism are very illiberal. They attack the liberal idea, even though they sometimes purport to do it in the name of liberal values. So social justice, for example, is a liberal value. And liberalism was concerned with having both individual justice, meaning justice between individuals, and also social justice. In other words, justice for society as a whole. This is an old preoccupation of classical liberalism. In fact, if you go right back to Plato's Republic, Here's Socrates, and he basically says, let me try, and I'm going to only do this in speech. I'm not going to do it in reality. In speech, meaning through ideas, let me construct a just society. What would a just society look like? And so we see this concern with justice going to the very beginning of our civilization. Now, you are right that the idea of liberalism is connected with the idea of openness, of freedom. It comes from liberalis, the free man, as opposed to the slave. And you cannot have liberal education without openness of mind. Now, by and large, openness of mind means being open not only to the future. This is the progressive idea. Let's always focus on the future. But what about an open-mindedness toward the past? What about trying to understand the past under its own terms? So when you try to understand somebody like an Abraham Lincoln, and people say, well, wait a minute, didn't Abraham Lincoln say that if he could fight the Civil War without freeing a single slave, he would do it? Yes, he did say that, but he said that at a critical time, and he said that for a particular reason. So unless you understand the reason why somebody like Lincoln would say that, and in this particular case, he said that because he wanted to keep the border states, which, by the way, had slavery, but had not seceded. He wanted to keep the border states in the Union. And he realized if I frame the Civil War as an argument over slavery, all the border states which have slaves will join the Confederacy. But if I frame this as an argument over saving the Union, I will be able to keep those border states in the Union. So again, a liberal approach is an approach of trying to understand a man like Lincoln in the context of the situation facing him at the time. It's not enough to say, well, you know, we in the 21st century really don't like slavery, and if we were Lincoln, we would have decided something differently. We're superimposing modern conditions on people who had to make very different types of decisions because they faced very different circumstances.
Mm. That's so important. That is absolutely so important. And if we don't help our kids and ourselves, we don't get that bigger, larger context and understand these ideas from classical liberalism, we just think there's only one way, and that's what we're getting from the left. How seriously should we as parents and grandparents consider alternative forms of education? I mean, I went to public school as a kid, but we did not send our kids to public school when we were raising a family. How important is it today, with where we're at, to really start considering homeschool and private school?
Well, I think that the original rationale for public schools has completely disappeared. So when public schools became common in the 19th century, they had a kind of assimilation function. The idea was that people are coming to America from all over the place. Many of them are from, you know, Eastern Europe. There are Jews, there are Irish, there are Italians, and then later, of course, Koreans and West Indians and Pakistanis and so on. And the idea was that they need to be drawn into a single common culture. And the public schools, believe it or not, were set up to do that. Now, you can ask, are they doing that now? Absolutely not. Not only are they not doing it, they don't even want to do it. They actually, far from emphasizing our common culture, they emphasize the opposite, our differences. They emphasize, if you will, identity politics. Are you black? Are you female? Are you trans? Are you this? Are you that? And they try to italicize or highlight those differences. Mm. So I would say, by and large, our public schools are teaching little or no education. I would suggest for all parents, we need to find alternatives of one kind or another. And this needs to happen not only at the school, but also at the college level.
And if we pull our kids out of traditional education for a better form of education, are we abandoning something that needs to be preserved? Should we be salt and light in a public school system and say, hey, that's what it's all about, is influencing? Or do we need to take the approach of, no, if we send our children to Caesar, they're going to come back Romans, and so we need to abandon that whole plan?
I think abandonment is the right approach for this reason, that you can't be salt and light when you're kind of at the receiving end of something. So if you were to ask me, should parents try to get on school boards? Yes, they should do that. You can be salt and light that way, as long as we have public schools. And of course, some people are not in a position to do homeschooling, or they can't afford private education. And so I'm not saying there may be parents who have kids in public schools, and then they should do what they can to exercise parental involvement and leverage over the school to make sure that the school is actually teaching what it ought to teach. I think, you know, one of the silver linings of COVID is a lot of parents, you know, their children were getting indoctrinated right and left, but they didn't know about it. Mm. But when they started doing this stuff online, the parent sort of ducks into his or her kid's room and they go, wait a minute, what are they teaching Johnny? And so the parental movement against critical race theory, against some of this ideological indoctrination, was as a result of parents' eyes being opened in the wake of COVID, because they finally realized what's actually going on in their kids' classroom.
Dinesh, you had mentioned in just a moment ago, critical race theory. For a lot of people, this is starting to become a household phrase. Can you help us understand what is CRT, critical race theory?
Critical race theory arose out of an earlier movement that was simply called critical theory. Now, who are the champions of critical theory? By and large, these were leftist or Marxist theoreticians, scholars, who were writing in the early to mid part of the 20th century. So Marx thought that basically the world is divided into two kinds of people, the working class, and these are the people who are oppressed, and the capitalist class, and those are the people who do the oppressing. And so for Marx, class was kind of the lever to drive a wedge through society, to create revolutionary resentment, and ultimately to cause a revolution itself. So critical race theory takes this whole framework on board, it embraces it, it just adds one element. It takes the idea of class and replaces it with the idea of race.
The whole point, though, of critical race theory is allegedly to help us to actually heal racial wounds and promote racial reconciliation. Is it going to do that?
Absolutely not. And I think that if you probe the critical race theory guys, they're generally honest enough to say that that is not their goal. This was, in fact, Martin Luther King's goal. What you're describing, Martin Luther King, a whole generation ago, used the phrase the beloved community. And Martin Luther King's idea was really very simple. And that is that the line between good and evil does not run between the races. It kind of runs through every human heart. And so there are good people in all groups, and also justice and racism is something that that can be outlawed by outlawing it on the individual level. And by that, I mean we have an individual right to be judged, as King himself said, on the content of our character. By the way, right. Notice that King doesn't just say merit. He says the content of our character, which is a bigger idea than merit. But if you present this idea right now to any critical race theory guy, they'll start laughing sarcastically. They will say things like, well, that's the only line from Martin Luther King that you know and you seem to keep quoting. So what they do, they want to get away from that. The idea of color blindness, of treating people as individuals, this is not what they are all about. Basically, what they're all about is italicizing or emphasizing race for every minority group except for whites. So they want every ethnic group to feel excited and proud of their heritage and to make demands based upon it, but they want whites to be disgusted, shamed, and humiliated over their own heritage. And they want whites, it's not even that you can say, well, okay, you know what, I understand a lot of bad things were done by white people, and I'm going to repudiate those things. And therefore, can I gain some sort of immunity because I don't want to be part of all that? And the answer is no, you can't. You can't gain any immunity. Why? Because you're white. And so even though you may not intend to be a racist, you are nevertheless a beneficiary of what, and we've all heard this phrase these days, white privilege. And so essentially what you have here is a kind of never-ending wedge between the races. And far from getting away from race, which I think was always the goal of liberals.
Wow, it's so interesting. Now, I am a father of six. My wife and I, obviously, you look at us, we're white. And of our six kids, I have two children who are white. One is brown, three are black. And so it baffles me. Am I supposed to look at my family as a mixture of people and children and treat some of them as inherently racist and others of my children as part of a permanently oppressed class? I mean, is that really what I ought to be teaching my own children?
According to critical race theory, yes. And their reasoning
Wow.
kind of goes like this. Their reasoning is that your black children are going to be black in a society defined by white privilege. So no matter what you teach them, in fact, no matter what kind of benefits you give them, it doesn't even matter if they're multimillionaires, the argument goes, they could still be pulled over by a cop because they're black. Driving while black is one of the kind of favored phrases of the CRT or critical race theory movement. So their argument is that you cannot get away from these things, and no amount of kind of wholesomeness, no amount of your black kids and brown kids and white kids growing up together can heal these wounds. In some ways, it's a very despairing philosophy, but at the same time, it's also a racket. And what I mean by that is that these advocates of critical race theory are all, they all view race as a business. In a weird way, if you say to them, you know, would you be happy if racism were to sort of disappear overnight? We'd never have another ounce of racism. They'd be terrified because it's kind of like telling a car salesman, would you be happy if people stopped driving cars?
That's a whole paradigm shifter, you know, and I think that, I know that, you know, in the circles of people that I talk to and as I look around and travel the nation, nobody wants to be called a racist. Everyone's so afraid that they're going to be viewed as some sort of a bigot that they just want to backpedal and virtue signal and make sure that no one sees them that way. Are you saying that maybe we don't actually need an emergency solution to deep systemic racial problems, but we're actually witnessing a very clever tool that is straight out of a Marxist playbook that's designed to divide and weaken us? I mean, that sounds sinister. And if that's true, why in the world would anyone want to divide us as a nation? The whole point is we want to be united.
Well, that is exactly what I'm saying. And I think I can prove the point pretty decisively. So you just correctly described, I would say 99% of white people when you said nobody wants to be considered a racist. Now, think about this for a minute. What you're really saying is that deep down, inwardly, every white person pretty much rejects the code of racism. And therefore, if you accuse them of being a racist, they become very angry and defensive, not only because they don't want to be seen as a racist by society, but they don't want to see themselves as a racist. In other words, they have an inner moral code that rejects racism. Now, quite honestly, Kirk, if somebody were truly a racist, they would be very proud if you accused them of being that.
That's right, and I've heard them say so.
Imagine if you accused me of being Indian. You won't get angry denials from me. I'd be like, sure, yeah, I'm Indian. You're right.
That's right.
I'll take that as a compliment. So real racists are not ashamed of being racist. It's only people who are not racist who can be played with the accusation of racism, because only non-racists respond by going, ah, you know, this is like Dracula before the cross. They don't want the accusation of racism because they really aren't racist.
That is such a great point. Man, I want to rewind this and go back and listen to this. I can't wait to do that with my wife and my kids. You know, I think that with all of these phrases that are becoming household talking points in our homes, and all these acronyms that we're hearing, I wonder why we, as members of the family of faith, who have a set of values that have produced the greatest civilizations in the world, who understand that there is a God that has made us and loves us and has a plan to set us free from the shackles of sin and guilt and abuse people because of our own selfishness, why are we always on the defense? Why are we always the ones to say, oh my goodness, CRT, what is that? Here's a new acronym. Now we have BLM, or it's some series of letters that is some phrase that we're afraid of and we're trying to figure out what to do about it. I say we come up with some of our own acronyms. Why don't we have something like CFT? How about critical faith theory that all the news stations are talking about? I think George Washington might be the head of that organization. I think it was him that said, it's impossible to rightly govern the nation without God and the Bible. I mean, this is just basic history. This is stuff that anyone has known, even people who were a little more irreligious. You take Benjamin Franklin, and he understood that without Christianity, without true faith, that is critical, he said, in order for us to be free, whether we're a believer or not a believer, in a country like this. Why don't we get on the offense with that kind of thing?
I think the real problem is that Christians are a little intimidated to live in secular culture. Let's remember that this is a new experience for Christians in America, because American society and Western society generally used to be Christian society. And you could go, let's just say in America, 1950, if you were to say to people, and it didn't matter if they were Christian or Jewish or maybe not even believers at all, if you were to say, hey, listen, what if every American were to follow the Ten Commandments? Do you think America would be a better or a worse place? And I think most Americans of whatever background would go, I think it would be a lot better. So that's the definition of living in a society that is built on a Judeo-Christian foundation. Now, in the last sort of 50 years or so, we have been moving increasingly into secular culture. And in secular culture, you've got these kind of, I would call them secular prophets. These are secular radical leftists, and they come screeching into the public square, and they say things like, how can you be a real Christian and endorse racism? How can you be a real Christian and not accept that our society is fundamentally, systemically, institutionally racist? And see, the typical pastor, the typical youth pastor, the typical Christian in the pew is a little intimidated, and they go, oh, well, wait a minute. Yeah, you know, how can I be a real Christian? You know, I need to basically, so, and then right away the surrender process begins, and the surrender process is the one in which the Christian now allows secular values to dictate the way in which Christianity is understood. So far from taking Christianity to the world, think of it, we're supposed to be the church's missionaries to the world. Some of these Christians have become the world's missionaries to the church. And so they say, oh, yeah, let me take critical race theory and bring it into my church. So they're actually trying to take secular values, very often secular values, antithetical, at least in key respects to Christianity, and use those to transform the church and not the world.
If we were to open up the playbook that God gives us on how to move the ball the other direction on the field and begin to start moving toward winning the cultural game, what are just maybe one or two important plays that we need to put into action right now?
If we could come up with an online university. Now, online universities today, by and large, are low cost, but they're also low quality. But can you imagine if you were to assemble, let's say, the 100 leading scholars and the best teachers in the world, and you pluck them from the think tanks, you pluck them from all over the world, and you offer a world-class online education for like $3,000 a year. Very doable, very achievable. That kind of a university, by the way, could have an unlimited number of students. There's no reason it couldn't have 1 million students. And if you could offer it at $3,000 a year in one stroke, you would make all of academic higher education obsolete. You wouldn't have to fight about this university and that university and can we take Harvard back and what can we do about Texas A&M. You don't have to do any of that. It's kind of like inventing the academic iPhone, because the moment you've done it, all rotary phones are obsolete. And so what I'm getting at is this is the way we have to think. We have to think in terms of the supply side, creating new institutions of education, of entertainment, and of culture, in which we just defeat the other side in the marketplace of ideas, because our stuff is simply better.
Absolutely love it. And Dinesh, I think you might be called to the world stage at this time for a purpose just like that. We have had some great conversations today. And before you leave, I want to make sure that we have our takeaways for this episode. The knowledge that we've gained that can improve the way we think and better our families and our community. One, honor the Sabbath. You heard Dennis Prager talk about how honoring the Sabbath was helpful to instilling values in his family. Taking time every week to tune out the noise from the world and just be present with family, friends, and God will do a lot to root you in faith and community. Two, fear God. Dennis also mentioned how fearing God is a way to grow in courage. Knowing who we answer to at the end of time will help align us in the here and now and give us confidence to face whatever the world will throw at us. Three, take control of your kids' education. Both Dennis and Dinesh spoke about the importance of what children are being taught in schools. So seriously consider homeschooling or private education if you can. If you can't, do your best to engage. Maybe even run for your local school board to make sure that you can be a strong and effective influence. 4, don't let the world minister to you. As Dinesh said, don't let the prophets of the world convert you to their gospel and disciple you. Like Romans 12, verse 2 says, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. Hi, I'm Kirk Cameron. Thanks for listening to this episode of Takeaways. If you love the conversations that we're having, please follow or subscribe to this podcast to never miss any of this great content. And please consider leaving a positive rating and a review to help others like you discover this show.